Hello and welcome to the second Strand Group podcast. I'm your host, Martin Stonaday. Today, we're going to talk about the connection between politics and food. I'm delighted that today we can chat to a King's College London professor, the winner of Britain's Best Home Cook, the presenter of shows such as Travels in Trumpland, Travels in Euroland and Inside the Care Crisis. He gangnamed himself into popular culture on series 14 of Strictly Come Dancing. He's the author of Speaking Out and Appetite, plays the piano and ukulele, and he also managed to be the Shadow Chancellor, Secretary of State for Children, Schools and Families, Chief Economic Advisor, a leader writer on the FT, and a Harvard professor. Ed, welcome. What have I missed from that introduction?
I don't know, but it sounds like a long time ago, the sort of Shadow Chancellor and Cabinet Minister. Sometimes it certainly feels like a different world. I definitely didn't play the ukulele then.
I think you've got a reverse hinterland. Your hinterlands come after politics.
Well, you know, I was playing the piano and doing the marathons and cooking all the time I was doing politics, but maybe once I lost my seat, there was a bit more time. But lots of people in politics have hinterlands, and Dennis Healey famously had a massive one. But I think for me, Dennis Healey was always a bit of a role model. And so pleased to follow in his footsteps.
It's great to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us. We're having you on because you recently discussed this topic, food, family and politics, at a Strand Group event at King's with the judge from Britain's Best Home Cook, Angela Hartnett, and fellow finalists on that show, Rachel Johnson. It's also a topic you cover in your book, Appetite. How did that book and this event come about?
Well, look, how did the event come about? Goodness knows. I mean, the Strand Group normally discusses central bank independence or, you know, the Blair Brown New Labour years or kind of issues around the financial crisis or all these kind of things. And so I think it's the first time we ever had a discussion about whether you should taste before you serve and the right way to make a souffle. But, you know, there is, as we'll discuss today, lots of links between food and politics. And it, partly the motivation for the event, I think, was in the Best Home Cook kitchen, Angela Hartnett, the Michelin-starred Angela Hartnett, would always come in every morning talking about what she'd heard on the Today programme that morning. Claudia Winkleman and her were always talking about politics before we got down to the cooking. And so it was a bit unexpected for me to be there. I was supposed to be in America filming a BBC film called Return to Trumpland. We were going to go and see how the Trump voters were faring in the run-up to the American presidential election, how they were thinking about Joe Biden. But of course, we couldn't go because of COVID and the American borders were closed. And I got a call to say, given you can't go to America to see Donald Trump, would you like to spend a month in a kitchen with Mary Berry, Dame Mary Berry, instead? And I thought, well, you know, from one global iconic figure to another, do a bit of home cooking. Sounds fun. So that's how I ended up in the kitchen. As for the book was, well, you know, I'd won this show rather to my kind of surprise. And, you know, normally books with recipes in are written by top chefs and, now, I'm not a top chef, I'm just a home cook. And these are just like our family recipes. But then Holly Hunter at Simon & Schuster got in touch because she said she'd been thinking about this after the last pandemic in 2021. The big American bestseller was President Theodore Roosevelt's book called Letters to My Children, in which he reflected about what his children had taught him, what he'd taught them, bringing up kids in the early part of the 20th century. And it was a big bestseller because it sort of caught the mood of America, which had been so kind of shut down in the pandemic, lots of time spent at home. And I spent most of my time in this pandemic cooking for our kids. And so Holly said, why don't you write about recipes and what they tell you about family, food, politics, life, all those kind of things. And once she had that idea, I mean, it made sense, and I actually did it very quickly indeed.
It's a fantastic book. I do recommend it. Talk to us a bit about this connection between food and politics. Political meals, they're really important, aren't they? They set the scene and the agenda, and they're sort of a, food can be a shorthand in politics, can't it?
Well, the disappointing thing, I think, is it's not actually ever about the food. So yeah. If you actually really like the eating part, or you particularly care about the quality of the food. I mean, I've been to loads and loads of finance ministers' meetings around the world, and, you know, the kind of the Treasury, G20, G7, all those kind of things. And it's almost always the case that food is served, because partly because the days are very long, and partly because if you're trying to get to an atmosphere which is relaxed and where people can open up a bit, then food is sort of ice-breaking. It's not just a formal meeting around the table, but very rarely is the food important. There was one moment I remember really well out in Washington at the IMF meetings. Gordon Brown was in the chair. It was the G20, all the finance ministers sitting around the table. I was in the UK chair, so I was taking Gordon Brown's chair. Next to me was the then French finance minister, Nicolas Sarkozy, went on to be the president. And we were having this big debate around the table about representation of the emerging market countries in the IMF, and should they have bigger quotas? Should they be expected to pay more money in? It was quite heated. The Americans had a view, the Brazilians were talking, Gordon Brown was chairing. And suddenly Nicolas Sarkozy turned to me at about a third of the way through the lunch and says, "This is ridiculous. These Americans, what do they think they're doing?" And I thought he was making a comment to me about the Brazilian quota or Mexican contributions. And he gestured towards his plate and said, "Do they expect us to eat this?" This was a French finance minister who clearly did not approve of the American style steak. And for him, he couldn't focus on the policy because he was so appalled by the food. That was an exception to the rule. And I think Gordon was always seen as very serious and focused, but he was never really seen as much of a foodie. And as a consequence, you know, he could not eat the kind of Japanese sushi or creamy Luxembourg veal. And people would think that was because he was a very driven guy. But the real answer was because he had rather a narrow palate. He liked spaghetti bolognese, lemon chicken, lambuna with a pochoiri naan and well-done steak. And that was about it. So most of this fancy food, he wasn't really that keen on.
Here are Angela Hartnett and Rachel Johnson speaking at our recent events about their lives in family, food and politics.
Are there famous people or famous political moments which have happened in one of your restaurants, do you think?
Oh, well, it's interesting. When we were at the Connaughts, we did have... There's obviously a lot of courting that I was completely oblivious to. But Gordon Brown, one Sunday night, was in with Murdoch. And there was always these tables that you sat people on that you knew they wouldn't be seen.
Right.
And so it was always table 35 in the far corner. And so you wondered, you know, and then I think next week he was in with Andrew O'Neill and you sort of think, oh, where's all this going on? And then, but one of the best political moments, or one of the slightly scary but sort of slightly ironic afterwards, is we always used to have Benjamin Netanyahu stay at the Connaught, and they would take the whole of the one floor when he stayed. And he happened to be in the Connaught the day of the bombings in, you know, July, in that month in July.
What, 7-7?
7-7, yeah. And, you know, and when Mossad's there, they're rigid. They, you know, we had Tony Blair come in one time and, you know, the British security, you know, we said, "Would you like anything?" "Oh, Angela, lovely." You know, they sat down and had dinner. You speak to Mossad and they're just like this. They just literally, you know, earphones in. You'll go, "Excuse me," trying to get trays around them. Anyway. And so that day, I got to the tubes, weren't working, hadn't quite clicked, you know, and was walked into work and something, and then realised when phone's going off, what's going on. We get there, obviously there's no one in the restaurant, very few people in the hotel. Mossad have closed down, obviously, around the Prime Minister. And at lunchtime, I walk up to the restaurant, and he's literally sitting near the window. And I said, "Could someone, given the fact that London's just been bombed, remove the Israeli Prime Minister from the prime spot in Mayfair?" You know, and it was just...
Anytime you ever see any group of MPs socialising in a restaurant, you just assume it's a plot.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's turned full circle.
Well, we always used to have a lot of the MPs come into Cafe Mar and St James, because obviously it's the top of sort of St James's Street. So we've always had quite a big show in there. But ironically, the only people that recognise them are me, you know, because most of my staff, and there's no disrespect for them, they're young and Italian and they really don't, you know. And so I'll walk in and go, "Oh, you know, there was Theresa May when she was Home Secretary, or you see George, or whatever, you know." So it always made me, I'd go, "Do you know who they are?" They go, not chef. Who is that? Who is that? Anyway, it is what it is.
And is the Prime Minister a foodie?
Not at all. No. Absolutely. He likes
chef?
Food, though.
Is he a
no,
chef?
He has one dish which he calls Goski Patties, where he just opens the fridge and he gets out oats and butter and cheddar and whatever else, and he chops it all up and he fries it. That's his idea of cooking.
Okay.
It's not Lucky good. Carry. It's not good. I mean, everyone thinks that, you know, we sort of... I know, I think education is entitlement now rather than money. Mm. So the fact that he went to Eton and I went to private school, everyone thinks we're posh, but actually, I know, whenever I say this, people just go, shut up. But my mum didn't take any alimony, and there was no... Literally, there were years when there was nothing in the fridge. Mm, mm. And it's a sort of running joke that we used to eat the pickle.
Yeah.
And, you know, if there were peanuts in a jar, we were like... Kind of some you'd see the one of the my brothers just like pouring peanuts into his mouth. And one year, Christmas time, and my mother had forgotten to buy a turkey. And it was literally Christmas Eve, and we lived just on the Portobello Road. She said, go out into the market and get something. So Boris, Leo and Joe went out into the market, and it was all closing down, and they had to walk all the way up the Portobello Road, and they found this halal butcher. And they didn't have any turkeys left. They didn't even have a chicken, but they found a capon.
Nice!
So this was fine, and it wasn't very big. But
how
we
many
brought
people
the
normally
it was
eat
like,
a capon?
I don't know, but we ate the capon. It was absolutely fine. Mm. It was, you know, but, you know, as you see, I can see that this story doesn't land because everyone just wants to think that
we were all
feather bedded
and
we were being waited on with nannies and things. It just wasn't like that.
Yeah.
But anyway, it is the truth, though.
We believe you.
And now more from my interview with Ed. Fantastic. Now, of course, as you revealed in our event at King's, probably one of the most famous political meals was the Granita deal, the Granita between Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. And I think, Ed, you revealed that you were there, at least for a part of it.
I was there for the first part. And in a way... That's another aspect of politics and food. Sometimes it can be about the atmosphere. Sometimes it can be about bonding within your tribe. But sometimes when it's about power, inviting somebody to your place and them eating what you choose or in your environment, it's about establishing the dynamic. And this was the moment where Tony Blair and Gordon Brown were deciding that Tony Blair was going to be the candidate to be leader and prime minister, not Gordon Brown. And Tony Blair wanted to have a moment where this was sort of agreed. And so it being done over food is very kind of, very typical, I think, of that kind of, you know, the breaking of bread. I mean, there's a long history of important moments where food and drink is taken. And it was a power play in this case because, you know, Gordon Brown, I don't think had ever been to a shishi Mediterranean restaurant in his life, let alone on Upper Street in Islington. And it's indicative of the times. This is 1994. They thought they could get away with a private dinner in a restaurant on Upper Street. I mean, today it would have been on Instagram before they even sat down. So Gordon Brown says to me, you'll have to come. And I said, well, why? He said, well, I don't know where it is. But actually that wasn't the real reason. He just wasn't his kind of place. And I said to him, I thought I might be a bit of a gooseberry at this event, this tete-a-tete. But he's having none of it. So we arrived and Tony Blair's at the back of the restaurant. We went in, looked at the menus. The first thing Gordon Brown said to any of us was he turned to me and said, what exactly is polenta? which I'm not sure I knew at the time. Tony Blair had, I'm pretty sure, chipirones, which is like baby squid. Gordon didn't have that. You'll be unsurprised to know. In fact, I'm not sure what Gordon did eat, because after the starters arrived, I finally said, look, you know, I'm going to have to go because it was getting too much. And I got a cab back down to meet Sunai, Charlie Whelan, Ed Miliband down at 4 Milbank, the Atrium restaurant. And an hour later, my phone rang and it was Gordon Brown. And he said, I'll be there in half an hour. He said, well done steak and chips, please. So I don't know what was served in this Mediterranean restaurant, but that was another occasion where Gordon Brown was too focused on the politics to eat the food. And there are lots of different views about what was agreed that day. And Tony Blair will have a memory, and Gordon Brown will have a memory, and we all have a view. But the one thing I can absolutely guarantee is, if you said to either of them, what did they eat?
No chance.
No idea. No idea.
Wonderful. I think aptly, Granita became a Mexican restaurant called Desperados, which I think, right. You know, is a prophetic fallacy, or whatever you call it. That's fantastic.
I'm not even going to go into that, mine.
Obviously, yourself and Yvette both worked in politics for a long time while raising your family. Any occasions in which that kind of your family life and your political lives have overlapped, and how did you manage that balance?
I don't think that our political food family lives overlap very much. I mean, when we were in the House of Commons, when we were both members of Parliament, Yvette and I would not sit down and have dinner together or anything like that. We were sort of, things were very separate. We did have every year a constituency garden party in our back garden, where we've done it for 23 years now, overnight 14-hour pulled pork sandwiches with a spicy North Carolina vinegar-based pouring sauce. It would be fair to say the first year this was served, our local neighbours in Castleford were unpersuaded until, Martin, they taste it. And the moment they taste it, it's like heaven. And so these days, you know, I do 10 pork shoulders. I don't stay up overnight. We have young party members who arrive and tend the barbecue overnight. In the lockdown, when the garden party had to be on Zoom, we still did the barbecue, and then a group of people in with cars drove around the constituency delivering pulled pork sandwiches to party members. I think that in terms of food and family life, though, we had to work really hard to protect the children from the political process. They travelled up and down from Yorkshire and London every week. The earliest things they learned to read were, I think, our daughter's first word was Grantham. And they learned to read by spelling out the buffet menu on the GNER trains. But we were very kind of careful to protect Saturdays. And Saturday evening is my you know, strongest family time. We knew that we weren't going to work Saturday night. We would never, ever do an event, political event, Saturday night. I would cook something. It was often actually would end up being, you know, kids were a bit picky eaters, but they all liked steak and I would do these Cajun beans, which are really good. And a couple of glasses of wine. And then we'd have family film night. And so I've seen the first 20 minutes of pretty much every child suitable film going, but I never get beyond the first half hour. So I never ever knew, you know, did they find the ring, Martin? Did they escape over the mountains into neutral Switzerland, the singing von Trapps? You know, did the Incredibles prevail? I never knew. But while it was always a family joke that I would fall asleep, I always made sure that I'd done the cooking first.
I always fall asleep as well. For me, it's reading books to the little ones. I just cannot. As soon as you sit in their bed and start reading a book to them, you know,
I've got to say, it doesn't change. Even now, you know, me and my youngest daughter have watched now, since Christmas, we've now watched 16 series of Grey's Anatomy.
That's impressive.
To such an extent that now, me and my youngest daughter, we're both pretty convinced that were we to be faced with a medical emergency, there is very few procedures we now couldn't do. I mean, I wouldn't want to say we're trained, you know, pump 300 grams of epi. We'll have to crack that chest. But if ever I'm tired and fall asleep, you know, whatever age, there's nothing more annoying to a five-year-old than a dad who falls asleep mid-story. Yeah. And you know what it's like? Once you're in a spiral of it,
yeah,
very hard to stay awake.
Can't stay awake at all. You were once accused of a lasagna plot. Tom Watson famously had a curry plot. Is food essential to political scheming?
Well, I think actually it was the other way around. I mean, it used to be the case that if you had a group of MPs who were sort of meet in somebody's house, or a committee room. If you remember all the speculation when Michael Portillo was he planning to run against John Major when he installed phone lines, or kind of cabal meetings? So people thought, well, actually, the way to solve this is to have a meeting over a meal, because, you know, people go out to restaurants all the time, these MPs stuck away from their families. And so if we want to avoid it being seen as a plot, do it over food. And, you know, of course, Tom Watson is a classic of that. I mean, they were making a plan, but they did it in a West Bromwich curry house. I mean, I can guarantee you, a bit like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown, none of them will remember what they ate, but they definitely remember what they decided. But as a consequence of that, it then became that any time you ever saw members of parliament eating together, it must be a plot. And that's where we came unstuck, because I had said to my team when I was shadow chancellor, we were going to invite them and their spouses around just to our house. I did lasagna. And Yvette said, can I invite my team as well? So about 35 people all come around. I mean, I remember it very well, because I had to do meat, vegetarian, vegan, and gluten-free. I mean, it was a very complicated lasagna cook. And then it was very all wings of politics. I mean, people had voted for me, Ed Miliband, David Miliband, Andy Burnham, maybe even Dan Abbott. I'm not going to rule that out. And then the next Sunday, somebody had said something to a journalist, and a big story in the Sunday Mail, Ed and Yvette's lasagna plot. And basically, because we had served a meal to other MPs, it must have been because we were plotting, and therefore inevitably and obviously against Ed Miliband. And then, of course, when Yvette and I wasn't a lasagna plot, but clearly the plot failed. So, yeah, you can't win.
The lasagna was
a... Well, as a consequence of this Mail on Sunday story, I'm not sure who started it, but over the next 3 years, I mean, I must have cooked 20, 30, 40, 50 different lasagnas for auctions at fundraisers. I mean, they've gone for £1,000, £3,000, £5,000, £10,000. I've had to, for charity, I've gone and served them to people. And I used to sort of get a tin thing, like a foil tray, make the lasagna, but not put it in the oven yet, write out the recipe, cover it in kind of cling film, and then, you know, often on a Thursday evening I'd be on my way down to Parliament on the tube, clutching a half-cooked lasagna to hand over to, you know, the MP for Stoke North, who would then be auctioning it the next day. So I know they end up having a life of their own, those lasagnas. Still a cracking recipe, I've got to say. I use dried oregano and cheddar cheese. And on Best Home Cook, I remember it so well, Angela Hartnett looking at my lasagna and saying, it's a bit loose, you know, while it was in the pot. I said, I'm really sorry, Angela, this is how I do my lasagna. She said, dried oregano? I said, yep, cheddar cheese. But she had to admit it was good. But if Mary Berry had said, I'm sorry, I don't like your lasagna, I would have had to say, I'm sorry, Mary, this is my mum's lasagna. And frankly, it is what it is. It's liked by those who need to like it, which may not have been fully entering into the spirit of the programme, I have to admit, but, you know, I felt quite strongly about it.
You're going to have to give me the recipe, Ed. I'm keen to try it.
You'll have to buy the book, Martin.
You went and did a photo call. This was after the Omni Shambles budget in 2012. You went to a Greggs with Ed Miliband and Rachel Reeves. Remind our listeners why you went to Greggs and how many sausage rolls you ordered.
Normally, when you go on a political visit, it's all been recce'd the day before, you know, all been planned out, and you get a detailed sheet telling you all the different things you're going to and the people you're going to see. And what can I say? Greggs in the West Midlands was not on the running order. The context was that George Osborne kind of bizarrely had gone off the week before the budget with David Cameron to Washington, D.C., and hadn't noticed that the officials had managed to slip in a whole series of things they'd always wanted to do, which tidy things up, but don't actually raise much money. So there was piddling amounts of money he was raising from, you know, a tax on skips, changing the taxation of fixed caravans. But the one which really caught the headlines was he changed the VAT rate if you bought hot food in a like a, you know, takeaway and a baker. So therefore, if you bought a cold sausage roll, it was taxed one way. But if you had a warm sausage roll or pasty, it was taxed another way. And so therefore, as part of this omni-shambles budget, this huge revolt, I mean, look, I was being lobbied like mad by the caravan owners of Yarmouth and Bridlington, the caravan manufacturers too. But this big uprising of people who like their pasty or the sausage roll. And so somebody, as we were on the train or going on this visit the morning after the budget or 2 days after, came up with this idea that we should go and visit at Greggs. Now, you know, what can I say? There was me, Ed Miliband, and Rachel Reeves. It would be fair to say that some of us have been to Greggs more than others. But as we kind of went in, I went into dad on the road off the motorway mode. I mean, you know, if you're traveling with a family, the one thing you don't ever do is not buy everybody a sausage roll, because even if they say they don't want one, they'll want one in half an hour. And we were in this minibus, and there was about 10 of us, me, Rachel, Ed, and seven staff. So I thought, maybe it was eight of us. I just figured, I had to buy everybody who wasn't a vegetarian a sausage roll. And the other thing you absolutely learn about sausage rolls for the family on the road is that the crumbs go everywhere. So I stride up to the counter and just thinking about the guys back in the van. So I said, I'll have 8 sausage roll, please, all in separate bags, which was, of course, exactly what you would order if you're a regular Greggs goer. But Rachel just burst out laughing. And Ed Miliband looked quite surprised. I don't think he understood the, I don't know whether he was thinking of the environment and the amount of packaging I was ordering, but 8 separate bags was not something he was expecting, although, you know, it's the only way to eat a sausage roll and avoid the crumbs going everywhere. And so to general laughter, I order 8 sausage rolls. People think they're all for me, which is totally unfair. And we stride out. However, the one thing which we have absolutely managed to do is provide a photo opportunity for the Evening News, which rammed home the pasty tax and the sausage roll tax of the omni-shambles budget. So in retrospect, I think, look, from my point of view, it worked very well.
It was probably preferable to going on a caravan holiday with Ed Miliband and Rachel Reeves, right?
Well, it was also preferable to eating a bacon sandwich, because the one thing about a sausage roll is it's possible to eat them in discrete bites.
That's true.
There are rules you learn about political eating, which is that that anything which you can eat in discrete bites is good. But a spaghetti bolognese, disaster. Pizza, almost impossible to eat, because the only way to eat pizza in discrete bites without it going everywhere is with a knife and fork. And who eats pizza with a knife and fork?
Yeah.
Bacon and eggs is fine. But if you put them in bread, you know, there's always a problem, which is it's never quite clear whether you're eating the sandwich or the sandwich is eating you. And it's very hard to, you know, the thing about a sausage roll is you can have a discrete bite of a sausage roll, especially if it's in a bag, and move on. Whereas the trouble with eating from a sandwich is it's very hard, especially if what's inside is a bit chewy. It's very hard to, you know, to get a bit technical, Martin. It's hard to complete the maneuver cleanly. If you think of divers in the Olympics going into the pool and the judges are asking, you know, do they go in straight? Is there a splash? It's possible in political eating to achieve the same effects, but not with spaghetti bolognese or a bacon sandwich, as I would have told Ed Miliband had he asked me.
Well, you know, there's a lesson for us all there, Ed. Talk about politicians and eating food, and reading your book, Appetite, as well. It seems there was sort of an almost macho culture around Tony Blair of fruit and vegetable eating, always pots of fruit on the go. And you mentioned Peter Mandelson's sort of aggressive manoeuvring with a salad. What about on your side of the divide? What about in HMT? I guess I get the sense it was more a sort of biscuits arena.
I think that, I don't know what it was, something happened when Tony Blair and his team went from opposition into government, because in opposition, they were always having kind of orders of prêt à manger sandwiches, which, you know, these days will feel like quite a kind of like a standard thing. But in the mid 1990s, I mean, this was quite
flash.
I mean, Shishi was quite flash, quite top end. I mean, you know, this is when people wondered, where's all the short money going? The answer is paying for all these pret-a-manger sandwiches. But it was kind of, you know, coffee and sandwiches. And suddenly went into Downing Street, and you'd go over for a meeting with Tony, and Tony and Peter would be there, and they'd be having, you know, I'd say coffee. Gordon would say coffee. Peter would say, I'll have a cup of hot water with a slice of lemon. And you thought, what? Where has this happened? Or, you know, kind of fruit teas. Now, it would be fair to say, again, over the following 20 years, in our house, Yvette all the time is drinking, you know, green tea, fruit tea, and chamomile tea. But, you know, back then, I mean, fruit teas were, I mean, it was new. It was a new idea. Certainly was to me. And as you say, kind of fruit. Now, Gordon, to be fair, did join the fruit cake craze in that there's nothing he liked more mid-morning than a couple of bananas. But I'm not sure whether that's kind of quite the fruit that we're talking about. And he really liked the Treasury canteen because, you know, it was either that or a ready meal. There's a brilliant guy called Kevin, who ran the Chancellor's kind of did lots of the delivering of this and took documents around and made the paperwork work. But he also was in charge of the coffee. It turned out that Jeremy Hayward had put in place a reform before we arrived in 1997, which was to incentivize, you know, good financial behavior, where Kevin was given an allowance and then, you know, and then kept the proceeds. I mean, it was very unclear and opaque. What these methods were, but basically what it meant was Kevin had a simultaneous incentive to serve as many cups of coffee in a day as he possibly could while keeping the cost per unit of the coffee to the barest minimum. And so I have drunk so many cups of the most rank coffee. But when you've been, you know, in Gordon's office for 6 hours working on the latest budget speech, I mean, what can I say, Martin?
You'll drink anything.
I'll take anything. If somebody had come in with a fruit plate, like they might have done in number 10, or, you know, a cup of hot water with honey and lemon, I'd have taken it. But frankly, Kevin's coffee and lasagna for one out of the microwave. I mean, you know, when we're desperate, we're desperate.
Wonderful, wonderful. Now, our listeners might not also know this, Ed, but for a period there, you often had breakfast with Jeremy Hayward. Tell us why you were having breakfast with Jeremy Hayward and where you were having breakfast with Jeremy Hayward.
So I'm not quite sure how it started, going to the particular place we went to, but Jeremy had moved over from the Treasury to become the principal private secretary. I think to begin with, he was the economic private secretary for Tony Blair, and then he became the principal private secretary, and he was the main interlocutor we had between the Treasury and the Prime Minister's direct office. Jonathan Powell would do political things and foreign policy, but Jeremy did anything economics and Treasury. And Jeremy quite liked being in control. He didn't particularly want the policy unit sort of rampaging all over this terrain. He quite liked things being tight. I think he and Tony would often say to the policy unit, oh, it's a nightmare getting any information out of the Treasury. But what they meant was, what Jeremy meant was, I've got the information, I'm just not going to pass it on to you because I'm going to keep it to myself because that allows me to keep control. So we decided we'd have a weekly meeting. But, you know, if I paraded into Downing Street, lots of other people would want to come to it. And Jeremy came to quite a lot of Treasury meetings, but this one, at the beginning of the day, you know, coming into the Treasury wasn't really necessary. And we thought somewhere neutral. And I think probably just once we said, why don't we have a cup of coffee at Churchill's, which was this tiny little cafe next to the Red Lion. And as a consequence, we went in there at 8:30 every Tuesday for, you know, 6 years, I think, because it carried on after Jeremy left. And we'd go in and we would go through everything. And sometimes David Miliband would come. Often the Gordon's principal private secretary would come, but generally, quite often it would just be me and Jeremy. It would depend on what was going on and who was about. But it was always the two of us, and we had, he drank a lot of strong coffee. We didn't eat much, actually. I think every now and then we might have had toast, but it was very much a business meeting. And we would just go through everything. And the ethos was that if something then came up that week, which was a problem or a surprise, which we had known about and hadn't said at that morning breakfast, that would have been like really bad. So it was the one place where you could guarantee that everything was going to be put on the agenda. We talked about every budget, every spending review. We'd have meetings to go through the detail of the spending review in the Treasury, but that was the one where the sort of the big politics was talked about, all in this little cafe off Whitehall. And the guys had no idea what was going on. I mean, I don't know whether, you know, I'm not sure if any foreign power or government would care what was being discussed in our budget. But if they did, all they had to do was put a bug in the corner of that cafe and they could have learnt a lot. But I don't think anybody
ever there did. Must have been so many journalists from the lobby who walked past Churchill's on a Tuesday morning on their way to the Palace of Westminster, what they would have given just to be sitting at the next table along from those discussions.
Well, it would be fair to say that you could have splashed a newspaper daily from the kind of things we were talking about, definitely. And quite often they probably did. We were stuck in the corner and it was not like we were sitting there with big files and lots of papers. We were just, I used to have business cards and I used to write on the back of them, and I've got thousands of these business cards with little things. And you'd come back and it was where we, if there's three things Jeremy was worrying about that week, we would go through and you'd say, okay, well, we'll do this meeting, that meeting. And I would say, I'm worried about this. Okay, that's what will happen. We just sort of agreed all the things which had to be done. And, you know, Tom Scholar would be there for when he was Principal Private Secretary for, he's now the Permanent Secretary of the Treasury. And then Mark Bowman came. It just tended to be only Jeremy from number 10. As I said, Jeremy kept things tight. But no, they were. So I used to walk in from Vauxhall and I knew that if by the time, if I left while the weather was on the Today programme, and I walked, I would not be late for my meeting with Jeremy. Whereas if I heard the pips, I was in trouble and then therefore I had to accelerate. And so it was like clockwork.
Fantastic. Ed, thank you so much for joining us. One last request before you go. Can you give us a recipe for our listeners to cook over the festive period?
Well, I think one of the things which will be surprising for your listeners, but I promise you this is true, is that the fanciest but easiest recipe to cook for the home cook is a souffle. And everything's souffle, that's really hard, but it's honestly not. The recipe's in the book, but I'll kind of tell you now broadly. You can do a big souffle in a big white dish, or you can do individual ramekins. And you basically, you make the base of a white sauce. So you cook butter and some flour, and then you make quite a thick roux, and then pour milk in, but not too much milk. It needs to be quite thick. Let it cool a bit with some salt and pepper, and then you put egg yolks into that and a lot of cheese. I tend to use cheddar cheese or a mix of cheddar and parmesan. Then you take your egg whites and you make them into stiff peaks, and then you fold about a third of your whites into that rich, cheesy, eggy roux, and then you fold the rest of the whites carefully into that mixture, so you get something much lighter and fluffier, and you put some more cheese in. And then if you're doing individual souffles, 20 minutes in the oven, a big one more like 40 minutes at 180. It always works. And actually, I don't even use a recipe now. I just kind of guess the quantities. I mean, if you do it for the first time, use the quantities. I will do this year for Christmas dinner. I'll do like a tureen. They've got 20 people coming for Christmas. I'll do 20 individual souffles and they're going to work. It'll be fine. Then the main meal with Yorkshire puddings. And I tend to do a Gruyere Parmesan thyme souffle. Cheddar works just as well as the Gruyere. A nice thing to do is to dial the cheese back a bit. and put white and brown crab meat in when the yolks go in and get a sort of cheesy crabby souffle. The other thing which I think works really well is buy some smoked haddock, poach the smoked haddock in for like 5 minutes in milk, and then flake the smoked haddock with a bit of double cream and some salt and pepper in the bottom of your ramekin, and then use that smoked haddocky milk. You might have put a bay leaf in, or but use that milk as the milk for your base for your souffle. So you infuse the smoked haddock flavor all the way through. Again, I would use much less cheese if I was doing it that way. And so then you eat this haddocky, fishy, a bit cheesy souffle. And when you get to the bottom, you find this flaky, creamy haddock at the bottom. It's really good. I can recommend it. And I promise you, it will work. It will rise.
I tell you what, Ed, I'm going to give it a go. I will feed back. I'm sure you're right. Thank you so much for joining us. I would say to everyone, go out, buy a copy of Ed's book, Appetite. It makes a really good Christmas present. Thank you so much for joining us once again, and we'll be back with another podcast in the new year. Thank you very much. Thanks for listening to the Strand Group podcast. For more information about the Strand Group, please visit our website at thestrandgroup.kcl.ac.uk.